Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Yesterday, the U.S. Department of Education released the results of the 2011 National Assessment of Educational Progress Trial Urban District Assessment. And the data looked at 21 urban school districts. It shows that urban education lags behind the country's suburban and rural schools. While cities gained a little bit of ground on math, the reading scores were stagnant. And while cities increased their scores, high-income students did the heavy lifting. The story out of Milwaukee is not great. Milwaukee Public Schools posted some of the lowest reading and math scores in the country in this test, and we're going to talk about it this hour of the program. In the study's 2011 math results, Milwaukee's fourth graders outperformed their peers in only three other cities, Detroit, Fresno, California, and Cleveland, rather. In eighth grade math, MPS students outscored only their peers in Detroit. In the reading results, Milwaukee's fourth graders outperformed peers in the same three cities. In eighth grade reading, MPS students tied with Fresno for the second lowest average reading score among the participating 21 districts. Joining us this hour to crunch those numbers, to analyze what's going on in classrooms and why MPS is not doing very well, as other urban districts in this country are not faring well either. Our guest has joined us on many occasions, Professor Stephen Correa, Associate Professor of Education at St. Norbert College. He says he comes from a long line of teachers. His favorite aunt began her teaching career prior to World War I, riding around on a horse to school over the mountains in rural Maryland. And he has many relatives who have dedicated their lives to teaching and learning, and he continues that tradition into this century. Before he attended graduate school, he was a high school social studies teacher, and he says that that experience allowed him to teach future students with a real-world experience that informs and directs his current classroom teaching. We'll be welcoming phone calls, and our number is 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Professor Steve Correa, thanks once again for being with us. Hi.
Very glad to be here, and good morning.
Good morning to you. Tell me about this test. Is this a reliable test?
The NAEP test, or the National Assessment of Educational Progress, is the gold standard. And the information and the process used in NAEP is studied both in education programs and statistics programs. So whether it's the process or how the information is organized or the outcomes, this is one of those tests that's sort of like the Framingham Heart Study, if anyone's familiar with that, that is both reliable and valid and a very strong indicator of where we are, because it offers this longitudinal view. And we all like to sort of react to snapshots, and there's nothing wrong with that because it's nice to pause and look at those sometimes. But really, it's trends that the NAEP test provides to us, and that's what makes it so valuable, because you don't have anomalies, you don't have huge changes at any one point, and so it really lets you be able to pause and look at where the bar graph is going, up or down, or what directions. And then they turn it loose and let people like you and I and everybody listening talk about it.
Right. Figure out what's going on. I thought this was a key sentence in this report: where cities increased their scores, high-income students did the heavy lifting. Obviously, poverty has a lot to do with these scores.
Oh, boy. You know, and while this is not an excuse for districts dismissing lower performance by non-white, non-upper socioeconomic class students, because there really is no excuse for that, it helps to understand that the way, you know, the reality of it is, the more money you come from, the higher your socioeconomic status. If your parents went to college, graduated from high school, or speak English as the primary language at home, you are going to do better on these kinds of tests. Now, that is about as shocking as hearing the noon whistle if you live
right.
in a small town. It's very predictable. But it gets reinforced in tests like this because some urban areas have begun to stabilize their school systems. Boston, for example. And so they've begun to attract parents of upper-income families that want to be there. And so those students, at least above the poverty line, have begun to really perform well, and that pulls the test up. Of course, at the other end of the spectrum, you have significant poverty issues, and I know that's been discussed strongly. But when you see incomes dropping, the free and reduced lunches increasing across the nation. In fact, interestingly, I live in Appleton. Last night, we got a phone call, one of those canned phone calls from the school district, that reminded us that if we have a child on free or reduced lunch, they are also eligible for free and reduced breakfast.
Interesting.
Now, in my 20 years in Appleton, that's the first one of those I recall ever getting. Now, that doesn't mean that Appleton doesn't have that program. They do. But they're realizing that this makes a difference with how students do in school. So, yeah, poverty is a real issue, and it has a definite correlation and causation, probably, with how students do on these standardized tests.
I wonder how many, I look at the MPS system, which I'm very familiar with, and the number of students who are on free or reduced lunch is just astronomically high. I wonder how many high-income students there are in these urban districts if we're not really looking at quite a segregated in terms of income and in terms of race issue here.
Well, largely you are, especially because those numbers are very, very predictable. Talk about reliability across school districts. You know, all of the 21 districts within this trial urban district assessment, they have very similar trends with income levels and race and then how they perform on the test. So you're really able to see, in essence, a flat line performance as you tease out these different subgroups, whether they're white, African American, Hispanic, Chinese, Native American, and income levels, you know, based on the free and reduced lunch poverty rate, that trend is very, very consistent across all of these districts. So you don't really see significant difference. So yes, you know, one can't dismiss that as not being a factor that dramatically affects performance on these kind of tests. It is.
You mentioned Boston, Professor Correa, that they had stabilized their scores here. What has Boston done, and are there other cities in these 21 who released their scores that we need to pay attention to because they've done well?
Boy, you know, that is really the $64,000 question, although with inflation, that's probably higher now. But, you know, one, Boston's public schools are smaller. Those people have, if you've been to Boston, the metro region is huge. The Boston city schools barely squeak in as one of these larger urban districts. So you're dealing with a slightly smaller number. However, Boston has tried a lot of different models, a lot of different styles of teaching, a lot of different methods of delivery. But one of the things that they've been very aggressive at is getting the information out with what works within their district. So staff development, training of teachers, and a more sophisticated collection of data, analysis of data, and application of data. You know, like if you go to the doctor and you say you got high cholesterol, don't do that. Well, that's probably not the best intervention. Let's talk about what an effective diet would be, et cetera, et cetera. Well, some of these schools, Boston included, have really put together, again, that data collection. Somebody's looking at it and understanding it, they're implementing it, and then they're sharing within the district what works and what doesn't work. And that is something that a lot of other districts haven't done. That takes money, that takes time, that takes expertise. And districts haven't been real aggressive at moving forward with that. Boston, and by the way, Austin has been, in Texas, has been pretty effective at doing that also. So those are indicators of districts that are thoughtfully moving forward and reacting in a reflective, professional way and not just sort of hiding under the desk when these results come in.
Well, let's talk about the training of teachers. You're an expert in this area. What is it that will work, and what do teachers need to know to be highly, highly effective in urban districts where there is a lot of poverty?
Boy, that's a great question. Well, of course, the easy answer is a lot. The more detailed answer would be probably a combination of understanding of the circumstances under which students come into the class with. Not all learners learn the same way. If you come from a Hispanic family and Spanish would be your primary language at home, well, how do they learn at home? What do they talk about? You have to know how family structures work. You have to understand where your students are coming from. From that, then, you really should have, now think about this, an elementary school teacher, and I think they're gold and I think they're wonderful. But, you know, they don't spend a lot of time with statistical analysis. But being able to look at test scores and talk with other professionals, reading teachers, math interventionalists, heck, one of the districts I work with have somebody who's an expert in working with blind students. And so the teacher is trying to learn Braille and how to prepare lessons for the student who's blind. Quite a bright young lady. But it's really a myriad of skill sets that teachers need. So they need to go in, they need to see, they need to come back onto campus, they need to talk about what we're looking at. They need to look at research. They need to go back out, find those things, come back. It's the good old professional development school model. Need to be the barriers between campus and schools. Need to be much more fluid. Need to flow back and forth. And, of course, all the while, teachers also need to be able to be building up their content expertise and their own professional development. So it's really a skill set that they need to develop. And places are doing that, but it's a challenge because the structure doesn't always support that. Sometimes it's everything from you have to get these classes done to I have to graduate in 4 years.
Right.
So, yeah. But there are some schools that are very, very impressive in what they do.
Is there anything we can learn from that favorite aunt who started her career before World War I?
Oh, that was my wonderful Aunt Billy. Yeah, when she told me that story when I was a kid, I was just trying to figure out how she got on the horse. But that was way in Garrett County in far western Maryland. And I think what she always told me was, you know, this sounds so trite, but it's not for anybody who teaches. You have to know your students, and you have to know what they're dealing with. Now, that doesn't mean you don't have high standards and high expectations. Of course, this is me interpolating. But you have to know what you're dealing with. And this one-size-fits-all doesn't work. Now, that's one of the things, the takeaways from the stagnant scores that we have. In many ways, we've, across the nation, there are practices and policies for teaching of reading and math and these types of things. We've really gotten the large core group, we've improved their scores, but we still have these students at the extremes. The achievement gap is widening in some of these groups. And we now know that we really need to be much more sophisticated with how we go about dealing with people that come from these variety of backgrounds. And teachers need to be able to develop those skills, and districts need to be able to distribute training in that and have the leadership in the districts to be able to do that. And successful districts are doing that. Boston is one to point to. I'm from Ohio, so I know a little bit what's going on in Cleveland. Cleveland does have pockets of elementary schools that are doing phenomenally. And again, it's leadership in those districts. It's not one size fits all. And it's teachers and other professionals, reading specialists, special needs, that are leading the way in that. And again, it's not this one size fits all. That doesn't work in anything. And we're trying to meet those students' needs with the expertise that the professionals have.
We welcome phone calls. Our guest this hour is Professor Steve Correa, Associate Professor of Teacher Education at St. Norbert College. And this hour, we're looking at the study released yesterday from the U.S. Department of Education examining 21 urban school districts, including Milwaukee, and showing very, very little or no significant improvement in test scores from 2009. Here's our phone number. I guess the question of the hour is, how do we do better? 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Rhonda Fanning is answering your calls this morning. She'll chat with you and get you on hold, and we'll be with you on the air soon. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program, we'll talk about electric cars, and our guest is the director of Revenge of the Electric Car. He's the same guy who did Who Killed the Electric Car. In this particular documentary, he takes viewers behind the closed doors of Nissan, GM, and the Silicon Valley startup Tesla Motors to chronicle the story of the global resurgence of electric cars. Should be a fun show. Professor Steve Correa is with us now, Associate Professor of Teacher Education at St. Norbert College, and we start our calls with Laura in Manitowoc. Hi, Laura.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Your guest's last comments, the last thing that he was just talking about, are a good segue into my question, which is, we all listen to these conversations on the radio and in the media about how our students are failing or how the kids in Wisconsin are underperforming compared to other states. And it seems kind of like we're spinning our wheels a little bit trying to find the solution. And I'm just wondering if anybody has addressed that question to the students. And by that I mean, you know, do they even know where they're performance level is and what these tests mean and how they're ranked against other kids in other states? And does that discussion take place? And, you know, I think we don't give our kids enough credit. They're very smart. And of course, you might not be able to have this conversation with a child who's in second grade, but to take a bunch of high school students and not ask them individually, what do you need to succeed, but kind of see if we can get at the core of the problem by asking them, what do you think the problem is as a whole? They might have some insight into that.
Professor Correa?
Yeah, that's an interesting kind of way to be able to look at that. And certainly a lot of ethnographers and people that do qualitative research like to go into districts and talk to students. Now, for example, we do know that to take this to one of its nth degrees, one of the primary reasons why students drop out of school, they see absolutely no connection with what's going on and what they want to do in life. Now, by the way, some of them aren't quite sure what they want to do in life, but they certainly don't see that correlating with what they're doing between 8 and 3. So there is work that does talk to students about that. One of the things I think the caller's also sort of getting at is, with this trial urban district assessment that Milwaukee was just with, it's called a low-stakes test, meaning that individual student scores are not reported, and the students are told that individual scores are not reported. So sometimes how we measure can have an effect on the scores that are produced. As another example, Ohio in the late 90s had this great idea for a high school graduation test. Everyone had to take the high school graduation test. They told them that it didn't matter how they did. Gee, guess about the attention that the seniors did. Well, the results were shocking.
I imagine.
Needless to say, they decided after a year that that wasn't a good idea to present it that way, and they changed that. By the way, when the current Republican frontrunner jumped all over that in the late 90s for the failure of public education. But back to what the caller, the lady from Manitowoc, is talking about, we actually we do interview students, or there is some work with that, but exactly how we would tease out and how that would affect the day, I guess there's some variability with that, specifically with changes that districts have made. Minneapolis schools, you know, they start now later. They start after 9 o'clock in the morning for high schools because, again, they responded to students and then the physiology of adolescents waking up later. By the way, that has had a positive correlation with attendance, and it has somewhat reduced the dropout rate. So I guess in that way there are some of those. Districts try to be responsive to some students' needs, but on the other hand, I could see some districts being really afraid with what some of those responses would be. So I'd say it's a mixed bag, but I don't know that it's driving reform efforts.
And just think how much better everybody would do if high school started at 10 o'clock.
Well, you know, and you know, it's sort of like if anybody out there has alcoholism that runs in their family, don't raise your hands, but it's a real thing. You know, we now know that that's not a character deficiency. That is not someone that was brought up in an immoral way. We treat it as a disease, and it's an effective way to deal with it. Okay. Adolescents waking up at 7 o'clock in the morning and going to school, it just doesn't work. And so the later that you start, the students perform better. Mm-hmm. You just shift the whole day from like 10 to 5 or whatever. They do it in San Francisco. They do it in Minneapolis. It's been effective. So, yeah, there have been some positive changes by literally looking at the student and not necessarily what's being delivered to the student. So that is a positive thing.
Thanks, Laura. We go to Brian in Cedarburg. Hi, Brian.
Good morning. Having been a teacher in Milwaukee Public Schools for 33 years myself in a high school, I'd like to comment on some of the reasons why things are not getting better.
What did you teach, Brian?
Well, I'd rather not say because I don't want to disclose my identity.
Oh, okay. Okay.
But the point being, attendance issue was always a big problem. Kids that would come 2 days, 3 days a week, and that was it. You had no consistency in the class that you were trying to present material to because a third of the class was gone on a given day. Another problem, you had just mentioned the start time of the school day. We did start at 7:30 at one point and then moved that to 8:30. It didn't make any difference. We still had a ton of kids coming in tardy, you know, hour late, 2 hours late. It didn't make any difference. Class size was a big issue. Excuse me. I had freshman classes with 45 students.
Oh, my. Mm-hmm.
And then a quarter of them were special ed kids. It was ridiculous. You cannot do justice to those kids.
And why were the students not coming to school or showing up 2 hours late?
Lack of structure in the family. The parents not there to wake the kid up. The mother, you know, single parent mother, she's already gone to work. The kids have the responsibility of getting themselves going in the morning. That's a big part of the issue. Another thing I'd like to bring up, we had chronically failing kids, 0-point grade averages, and yet they're mingling with the rest of the student body, bringing down everyone in terms of those were the kids that needed all the attention in the world because they were always getting in trouble. The smarter kids were literally ignored because you had no time to deal with them. There's, you know, I hear, of course, with our new governor that we have, the responsibility is being more focused on the teacher. There's no focus on responsibility of the student or the parent.
Professor Correa.
Well, Brian cannot be accused of sugarcoating the profession. So, but certainly, very respectfully to Brian, these are significant and consistently communicated challenges that teachers in classrooms deal with. So he's exactly right. While I don't know that one could exactly compare numbers across districts, these are you know, consistent issues. Attendance, enforcement with attendance is a big deal. You know, whether it's the good old-fashioned truant officer, that is a big deal. This idea of school structure, though, on the whole, start times do make a difference. Now, Milwaukee did change their start time. Obviously, then, this isn't a matter of adolescent physiology. This is a matter of getting the students to school. So enforcement is an issue. Now, teachers can't deal with that. My goodness. This gets back to some of those other issues with family time, you know, the challenges, parents that went to school, and the value that students place in education. Now, one of the questions, though, that needs to be asked is, and this is a tough one to answer, what can schools do about this? So far, we have basically one answer. We have a truant officer, or SIRS, that may or may not be in charge of enforcement, doing their job, and finding these people. We need to be able to look at a wider menu of options to get these kids in. You know, there's a whole number of reasons. Sleep, there's nutrition, there's family, there's busing, there's transportation. I mean, you know, we need to look at all of these issues, delivery models. But, you know, Brian is exactly right. This student is not going to do well on the test. And, of course, to lay this on classroom teachers and say now you are going to be evaluated based on the non-attendance and, you know, test performance of somebody that's not there, that's sort of silly. So the structure of the school needs to look at how do we address this, and that is the good old-fashioned sticky wicket. Some have been more successful than others, but boy, let me tell you, that goes back to Plato. How do we get them to school?
Right. Thank you very much, Brian, for the call. And I know there's a movement in many places to evaluate teachers based on test scores. When you look at a national report in urban districts that's this dismal, will a lot of teachers face bad evaluations and perhaps removal because of these kinds of scores?
That's a really great question. I think a lot of it will depend on how they do this. Now, what does this mean? Now, anybody that's been into a school, in fact, when your child comes home from school, oftentimes you'll say, how'd the day go? And
fine.
And, yeah, well, my youngest son, it's like, whoa, wait a minute. Sometimes other kids, it's like, you know, interviewing a suspect. You get nothing out of them. But when they use the noun, the teacher, do you know that means a single teacher? There's a classroom teacher. There might be a different history teacher, language teacher, music teacher, art teacher, gym teacher. So I think we need to look at these teacher evaluations. Who's going to hold the responsibility? Who's going to be held accountable for that performance? And what's the system in place to help that teacher to be able to know what's going on and to be able to help that student to do better? For example, if anybody's listening has dealt with physicians, everybody probably has a primary care physician, and that primary care physician directs your care. But have you ever tried to get your primary care physician to talk with a specialist and have you there at the same time? Holy cow. Mm-hmm. That is like talking to the IRS. Some places do that. It's an analogous system with schools. Do they have a system in place that allows that classroom teacher, for example, that third grade classroom teacher, to coordinate and direct the education of that child? Here's what the reading specialist says. Here's what if they go to math, here's what the special ed teacher says. Here's what all of these specialists say, and who's coordinating and directing that educational system. Now, if a system is in place to do that, and they're being informed in really good ways, hey, that's a great way to evaluate the system, and is the system working to help that child to perform well? That's effective. Now, but if these are disparate parts that never talk, and yet somebody is held accountable for not having any input, ooh, that's not going to work, because that's a punitive system and not a formative system. We want to be able to form a good way to be able to do that. And districts that are doing that have those, it's almost like an accountable care organization or good healthcare organizations that help to have everybody to talk. And you also can't do it when you have a single guidance counselor responsible for 500 students. These numbers are overwhelming. But if these systems are in place to be able to help this inform and direct a student's performance, phenomenal. I want my child to go to that kind of a system.
Right.
That is good. But boy, that takes leadership and that takes principals that are visionary, and you have to get the professionals on board. So back to Brian's concerns earlier, he's exactly, you know, correct in that we need to be able to have everybody on board. And so, hey, you need to have the truant people at that meeting. Okay, we're talking about little Stevie. Where is he? Who's responsible for that? Okay, now who's measuring that? Who's doing that? Who's accountable? And then you have a system in place. And schools are now only beginning to really have data systems that can be consistent and be trusted. Believe it or not, we've just sort of passed on report cards for years, one grade to the next, and except for the occasional attendance, we haven't done a lot.
His other point, which I think is an important one because you have some controversy about this, and I'm not sure why, if you have 45 students in your classroom, you just can't pay the kind of attention to each individual student that you may want to pay, that you, as you said earlier, get to know your students. That's a huge task with that many students.
It certainly is. And, you know, again, back to the medical example, doctors do cap their practices because they know that there's a limit to what they're able to do. Now, that practice of capping in education is not quite as easy. For example, in AP classes, and some of our listeners probably have children or they themselves went to AP classes, those classes are rather standardized. You know, today is the Monroe Doctrine. We're moving on. However, these are students that are there. They know what's expected. They're taking notes. Many of them have read the work, and they're prepared to go. So the higher the need of the students, clearly, the higher the number results in lower academic performance. However, the less needs of the students, the less need that the teacher needs to be able to have to intervene. So again, that's not that one size fits all, but I tell you, for my child, I want them to be in a kindergarten first grade class with less than 20. For my oldest child, who's in college prep type classes, he can handle anything, sort of let him go. But you're exactly right. You can't deal with 45 plus when you've got 15 with special needs, and there's some are there and some aren't. And well, they all have special needs, but this is capital S, capital N. You're not going to be able to do it. We can't do it. That's the warehousing model, and it's just not effective.
Mm-hmm. Dennis in Johnson Creek. Hi.
Hey, good morning. Say, having listened to these same discussions for 30-some years, you know, back when our kids first started in, you know, the elementary school, things don't seem to have changed much, which is concerning to a lot of us. But I understand that on a per capita basis, only Switzerland spends more than the United States. So it sounds like money isn't the answer. Is that the premise that you and your colleagues work on? And a related question, I believe the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation just finished a research on what makes a teacher effective, and they found out that nobody knows, including colleges, have never studied that. And are you aware of that, the Gates Foundation study, and your comments on that? Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, that's a great, those are just wonderful questions. We haven't been able to tease out exactly the issues that make for effective teachers. Now, we do know that there's a positive correlation between content area expertise, for example, in high schools. In other words, if you're a math major and you're teaching math classes, your students will do better on math assessments. We do know that. Same with history, chemistry, whatever. There are significant numbers that are teaching out of their subject area. And again, statistically, those students who have teachers that aren't trained in areas don't do as well. So we do know that. The difference in elementary school, boy, that is much harder to get. We do see a variety of skill sets that we seem to get. I think the main question is, what do we mean by effective? Do we mean performance on tests? Do we mean enjoyment of learning? Boy, there's one I want my student to have, a teacher.
Absolutely.
That encourages them to do that. So one of the things that the Gates Foundation has concentrated on is, again, anybody that looks at this wants to see what are some measurable outcomes. And so that is one that we have. We do know content area expertise and a major in that. But this whole menu of skill sets that good teachers need to have, you know, attention, organization, assessment, planning, lesson planning, meeting with parents, you know, it's quite a long menu. We have skill sets, but we don't know how that relates specifically to student performance. So again, we have some ideas, but the Gates Foundation is purposefully looking, because they have to. This isn't a criticism of the Gates Foundation. They have to look at very narrow measures of effective teaching. So other than content area expertise, they haven't teased out a whole lot. The Gates Foundation, by the way, has the money to get the headlines, but they're not the only group that's doing a lot of work with teachers, although certainly the caller is very aware with that. The other issue with money, we do know that we have spent more on education. The question is whether that's an effective use, and that's not so clear. Certainly, we can't say more money equals better student performance. I mean, that's just not the case. Switzerland has a much more homogeneous population. While they do have four primary languages, if you look at who they're surrounded by, and a little bit with Neuchâtel in the middle. But Finland is another example. Again, very homogeneous population. Aren't a lot of countries that have the heterogeneous populations that we do in the United States. So teasing out effective teachers here, very difficult, but yeah, we haven't quite decided it's a lot of money. I would bet less money isn't going to do any good, but I don't know that necessarily that just saying more money is going to do better.
Tom in Rhinelander, hi.
Hi, good morning. If I was a teacher, I think I'd be going wild right now. my daughter's a teacher, and she is a reading specialist now with the Greenfield School District. And she got there because she was an outstanding teacher who used a number of different techniques to try and get kids invested through their own interests in writing and reading. But and so there are techniques you can use to try and engage kids, but my comment goes more to, you know, if they're not engaged by second or third grade, you can talk about high school starting early or late, or, you know, chasing kids down and dragging them into the school till you're blue in the face. That's not going to make one damn bit of difference in their learning. These are kids, you know, when you look at Milwaukee, you have a huge percentage of kids coming from deep poverty, a history of failure or disconnect with the educational system, a non-reading home environment. So, you know, while suburban mothers are trying to get their four-year-old into Harvard already, you know, these kids have never even seen a book around their house. You have a physically and often dysfunctional environment with drugs and abuse and danger on the streets and everything else. So they bring this physicality to school with them, and the teacher then has to try and deal with just keeping calm in the classroom. You know, they have heroes who are, you know, physically aggressive, hip-hop, you know, and rap and so forth. I mean, you have to, you know, for teachers to be evaluated on that home environment seems to me to just be goofy. And unless, you know, we find some way, it seems to me, to address those fundamental problems and engage that community and speak frankly about these things, I don't see how you can ever ask the educational system to solve those problems.
Professor Correa.
Well, Tom speaks like the parent of a daughter who's a reading specialist, so that's just great. The examples, I have a feeling he did that with his daughter at home. They probably had lots of books around and encouraged education, and I could just see her trotting off to school in those early primary grades and liking it most mm-hmm. of the time. And when she didn't like it, I bet you she trotted off anyway because he was making sure she went. But, you know, one of the things that Tom mentioned was who's attracted into education to be interested in being a teacher? Now, one of the interesting things is my undergraduate degree, just as an example, is from Ohio State University. Interestingly, I don't know if this is an endorsement for me or not. I don't think it is. You can't get my degree at Ohio State anymore. I have a bachelor's degree in education. Now, I took content areas all over the place in social studies. However, now at Ohio State, Indiana, Minnesota, a few other Big Ten schools, you have to have a bachelor's degree in a content area, and you have to have a certain GPA, and then you get your master's degree in more of pedagogy, the old-fashioned idea of teaching. So it really helps to weed out people from the get-go. You have to have this commitment. So you're going to get sharper people coming in. Finland, for example, only takes the top 10% of their undergraduates are accepted into teaching or even eligible. So that's an interesting one, the best and brightest going in. But certainly, when we're looking at what's going on in Wisconsin with the challenges that teachers are facing. Now, I'm not making a political judgment as to the current climate, but you cannot argue with the fact that morale is not lower, mostly for teachers. And that does not attract people into the field.
Exactly.
Any capitalists that are out there would also agree that the resulting lower take-home pay is not going to bring more of the best and brightest into the field. And so, you know, simple capitalist economics are going to say, do we have a structure in place to attract these best and brightest into schools? And so far in Wisconsin, that is not what has happened in the last year to 2 years. One can argue about summers off. That's not the issue here. Take-home pay is down. People make decisions in their own best interest, unless there are some wonderful Gandhi-type self-altruistic people out there. But the phenomenal group, I think, Walk on Water, School Sisters of Notre Dame, headquartered there in the wonderful city of Milwaukee, those groups just are not filling the ranks as much as before. So the altruistic motivation is not there. So who's attracted to deal with these? Boy, do we have a structure in place that is pointing to the future or bringing up this divide and conquer idea with who's to blame? And we have to look at that.
We take more phone calls in a moment. Our guest this hour is Professor Steve Correa, Associate Professor of Teacher Education at St. Norbert College. And we're looking this hour, we're going slightly beyond this because you have to, if you're talking about test results, look at all kinds of issues. But the U.S. Department of Education released their study yesterday looking at 21 urban school districts, including Milwaukee, which did not do very well in the study at all. None of the 21 school districts did very well, actually. So we're looking at, once again, why that's the case. And welcoming your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program, Chris Payne, director of Revenge of the Electric Car. Tim in Burlington, hi.
Yes, good morning. I have another direction I'd like to look at for why our scores are being so low. If you look at what high schools are doing right now, we're trying to push everybody to go to college. And in doing that, we've left like one-third of our high school and the rest of the school population out. And those are the kids that are never going to go to college. And the programs that they really need are like the automotive, small engines, welding, plumbing, carpenter, industrial arts. And we've totally gutted those out of our schools. So we've got one-third of the population of our high school sitting there knowing that there's no way they're going to college. What am I doing here? They're not going to even try to achieve. And we really need to address those people and get those programs back into our schools, get those teachers back into our schools so we can effectively teach that one-third of our population who right now, I think, are just going to waste and rotting in our schools.
Professor Correa.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that I enjoy doing is going back and looking historically at the recurrence of issues that come up. Pre-World War One, this was a big issue. Is it one size fits all for education? And are we sending kids to college, which, by the way, pre-World War One was maybe one-tenth of 1% that went on to college. Post-World War One, the numbers gradually went up. But this is a good, meaningful, classic argument in educational reform. Charter schools do address that to some extent. However, if the caller and anybody listening is aware, charter schools nowadays are really more oriented to different ways to deliver traditional academic content in non-traditional ways, meaning the project method or more lecture-oriented or language or environmental. There aren't a lot of charter schools that look at different skill sets that students are interested in. And certainly, the caller's talking about some of those with industrial or vocational. Anybody that might remember the name Hyman Rickover, he's also called the father of the nuclear navy, graced the cover of Time or Life magazine in the 1950s. He became a big educational reformer because we needed engineers and mathematicians to beat those Ruskies who were going to nuke us any minute. Math and science in the 50s became more important, so vocational training became less and less important. Wisconsin addresses that primarily, not exclusively, but primarily through the technical college system. Other states, Ohio, Pennsylvania, some schools back east, especially Massachusetts, Indiana, do this through sort of regional vocational schools, more for high school students. So other places are doing this with various mixed results. It has helped some students to stay in school, but we haven't done that as much in Wisconsin. But the current trend, right or wrong, is not vocational, technical-oriented. It's basic skill-oriented. Keep them in, keep them going, keep them focused, keep them doing this. And it's become much more narrow instead of, I think, what the caller's inferring, instead of much broader. And so that's a trend that we're dealing with. And again, the NAEP scores do not look at, do you like school? They look at very specific academic performance. Mm-hmm. So, again, the trend is not that direction, though some places are doing it.
Tim, thank you. Running short on time, we hope two more calls. Ralph in Little Suamico, hi.
Yes, hi. Thanks for letting me get on. I thought I was going to miss out. I was listening to this, and it just really was, I think, an example of what some of your callers have been saying is the experience of my son, who, when he was in grade school, was very much of an achiever and got to high school, and after his freshman year, he basically dropped out. He maybe went to school a couple of times a week. He'd leave for school, but he wouldn't be there. It was to the point where I didn't think he was actually going to graduate from high school. At some point, after he'd been a mechanic for a few years, he said, I'm going to go to college. Right now, he's getting his doctorate degree in physical chemistry.
Oh, my.
And when I ask him what happened, what he says is, there was no challenge to me. I was ignored. I mean, it was kind of like, I don't know if the teachers are intimidated or they don't know what to do or they're concentrating so much on the low achievement students that sometimes they just tuck these people in the corner and after a while they just don't go to school anymore.
Professor Correa.
Well, isn't it nice to have a happy ending?
Yes, it sure is. That's quite an ending.
One of the problems, interesting things with schools is we have a timeline that sort of ends at age 18. and we want to judge success at age 18. And, you know, life doesn't work that way. But, boy, we push those kids. Interestingly, in a class I teach last night, one of my students brought up David Elkind, the wonderful author of The Hurried Child.
Oh,
well,
my.
You know,
yes.
We hurry them in late adolescence, too. But the timeline currently is high school, you better be a success, and it doesn't always work out that way. So we have to get to know our students, and the structure doesn't always allow that. So congratulations to Ralph and his son. Sounds like he's going to get a job, too.
I think he probably is. Well, thanks, Professor Correa, as always, for a stimulating hour and being right on top of the news. Appreciate it, sir.
Very pleased to be here. My pleasure. Thank you.
Our guest, Professor Steve Correa, Associate Professor of Teacher Education at St. Norbert College. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production here in our studios based in downtown Milwaukee. Thanks for all of your calls. I love your response to education programs. You're right there with valuable questions and insights. We'll have news coming up momentarily, and then we will return. We'll have a fun hour talking about electric cars. All of you who own them, please call and let us know about your experience.